Marini's Media.
The Offside Rule exclusives.
Emil Heskey played 62 times for England, made 150 appearances for Liverpool and over 150 for Leicester, winning four League Cups, an FA Cup, a UEFA Cup as well in the process. Heskey has represented his country at the 2002 and later the 2010 World Cup, Euro 2004 and at club level, has scored 110 times in the Premier League, placing him 22nd in the all-time rankings. And now he's even released a book, Even Heskey Scored, to tell his story, which he now also shares with us here on The Offside Rule.
The Offside Rule exclusives with Kate Borsay and Lindsay Hooper.
I'm pleased to say that we are joined in the studio by Emil Heskey. Kate and I here, having devoured your book in a matter of days, we had like a reading contest.
A speed read, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And I wanted to start, Emil, first of all, with your earliest footballing memory and what springs to mind.
Playing-wise, it's just, I actually preferred athletics. Loved just running, sprinting. I used to race people up and down the school playground all the time. And then I went to junior school, and because I moved from one area to another, and I went to, and obviously you move schools and everything, and went in there, and they put a ball in front of me, and I was obviously quicker than everyone else, and just I was okay at dribbling. I found myself good at dribbling with the ball and moving it from one foot to another. So they just left me and let me play, and I always played a year above, and that was my first memory of playing football, actually playing football for a team. I didn't do that till a lot later on, partly because of the Christian faith. You go Sunday school, church on Sunday, and then Sunday school, and that never played Sunday football until later on, where they kept on begging my dad, and say, "All right, take him, go on."
I have him.
Yeah.
You joined Leicester's Academy, which in this day and age is a really big deal to be part, you know, to be signed with a football academy is like, right, this kid's destined for great things. We know it doesn't happen for a large number of kids. We don't hear so much about them, but we do hear about the success stories. Mm-hmm. Was it a big deal back in those days for you to be?
Yeah, it was. It was a little bit different. It was centre of excellence, we'll say. It wasn't quite academies like what it is now. And they'd gather a group of kids who were possibly the best in that city and surrounding little towns and stuff. So you'd gather them all together, and then slowly down the years, you'd just get smaller and smaller until you've got a select number of players. And yeah, I just loved play. I just loved sports in general. I played table tennis, I did pool, and you get this competitive streak about you, and you don't want to lose. You never want to lose on anything. So you'd come back, get good at table tennis, get good at badminton. But football was my thing, and went there, I think it was Tuesday, Thursday, and played on Saturdays.
As someone who is very sporty, I was pretty sporty as well, but I never found my area of excellence, if you like. Were you really relieved when you found football and thought, no, this is the thing that I can go right to the very top with?
I played everything, and I was good at everything.
Oh, you were that one. Yeah.
Annoying.
Because I was so quick. We played a little bit of basketball. I just didn't get the grasp of the actual shooting part of it. But everything else was fine. And then tennis I didn't quite like. Table tennis I was good at.
I used to play table tennis.
I loved table tennis. Then pool. Mm. Used to love pool. We used to have like a little youth centre. And they had all that in there. You'd go in the gym, you'd go in the pool, you'd go and play table tennis, you'd go and play the arcade games. Then there was a little football court, so most of the time you're on that. Then they had karate, they had kickboxing. So you'd join in everything.
So from hearing that, I'm going to change my question to how did you get channeled to football? Because if you've got that sort of mind that's loving all that variety, it's quite difficult to
become focused. Because football was the one that was being played all the time, everywhere. So my dad was cricket, or more cricket orientated. I played a little bit of that, but that was kind of a summer thing where football you play every time, all day, every day. And so that was the game that kind of just I gravitated to because you're just doing it all the time. Yeah, and athletics was more seasonal as well. Mm-hmm. It was just the one that was played all the time. So that was the one we gravitated to.
What were you like as a kid, personality-wise?
Quiet. Very quiet, just kept myself to myself, didn't really bother anyone if you didn't know I was there. You'd just think, oh, when did he pop up?
Mm. Because you're quite a physical presence. Yeah, you're what, 6'2", yeah, 6'1", tall guy. Yeah. Were you always... Did you always have that stature? So
no, that
kind of like a gentle giant thing.
Yeah, I was big, but I wasn't huge. When I say huge, I wasn't. I think I started to get big around 15, 16. Mm. And then, yeah, I was a big size then. I was this size, basically.
Do you think people expected you to be shy?
No. They expected me to be loud, and because I'm a big lad. Mm. So when I went in, but it helped in a sense when I went into the youth team and stuff like that. If you're loud, especially back then, I don't know if I could say it, but you're getting it. And especially now you look at kids going into the first team and stuff like that, initiations and stuff like that. I just kept myself to myself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And even like I was talking about it to someone the other day. When you're a kid and you're doing jobs, we used to have to do jobs around the for YTS. When you go to a first team dressing room, you knock and you wait. And you wait until someone actually tells you to go come in.
Yeah.
They don't do that now, but this is...
Which is a shame, isn't it, I think? Because you've obviously cleaned
boots.
Hundreds
yeah,
of
yeah,
pairs
yeah.
of boots,
I was,
right, in your
I was
day?
Gary Parker's. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was Gary Parker's boots. Yeah, so... Yeah, it is a shame, but I understand what why they're saying they got rid of a lot of that, because we used to have to clean the dressing rooms, clean the toilets, we used to do everything, the stadium. I understand, because it's got nothing to do with football. But it has.
But has it?
It has in a way, because it keeps you grounded and it keeps you humble.
Respect.
And
you
respect.
Know what it takes.
Yeah.
Because then you have targets. You know, one day someone's going to be cleaning my boots.
Yeah, and I'll take that next step.
Yeah.
So
this growth spurt that you were going through from about 15 onwards mm-hmm. coincides with the growth that you were having throughout the Leicester mm-hmm. teams. And you made your way all the way through to the first team. Mm-hmm. You played under Martin O'Neill in a period which will go down in history forever. But I wanted to challenge you, first of all, your thoughts that, looking back now, everyone talks about it as the world's greatest pub side. And I thought, do you find that insulting?
No.
No?
It's true. If you ever saw how we did things, you'd be like, how did they win so much? How did they? But it was just a team camaraderie. We knew we trained hard, but we played hard as well.
Mm.
And that was part and parcel of that football era as well. You know, you played hard, but off the field you worked hard as well.
Because you were playing with a lot older players,
yeah,
and of course
yeah.
that really was the norm.
Mm-hmm.
And you're quite interesting because you're a player who's sort of intergenerational, really, in mm-hmm. terms of that hardcore going out all the time. To then in your later career, you know, probably the latter years of Liverpool onwards, where it does get a lot more professional, nutrition and stuff, it all comes into
you
it.
You say Liverpool onwards, I was only 22 when I went to Liverpool.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Still
yeah.
a kid.
Yeah.
And that's what people forget. Like, and that was when I saw the change. I went from, and it's a change for good and sometimes for bad, because I went from a pre-season where you train until you nearly throw up, to a pre-season that was really structured and you can't run more than this because of your heart rate. And I always used to challenge myself. You kind of push yourself to that edge, really to the edge. And then you get, your heartbeat could be well over 180, 190 up there, but they don't want you there. They want you, especially when you're, when you wear the heart monitor, it's 160, 160, 150, 160, 170. But I was way past that at times when you're running, when you're really putting yourself over the edge. And I quite liked that because it made me feel a certain way. But then when you go to, when I went to Liverpool and everything's monitored and you've got your minutes and you've got this, it was hard to take at times.
Mm. You had people coming in for you before that move at 22. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing you, I think there's a picture actually in your book of it, at a press conference where you're sat alongside Martin O'Neill and very happy to be signing a new contract. Mm-hmm. And that was all coming from you. You know, you speak to Martin after that and he's like, you know, no one was applying pressure to Emil. He wanted to stay at that mm-hmm. point, even though people were circling.
Well, at 16, I could have left. But I hadn't played a game. I hadn't played a game, so I hadn't done anything in my eyes, and I knew what I could do. So I'd had it in my mind that let me get into the first team first and then see what happens from there. I knew I was only a matter of time from the first team, and I just wanted to play for Leicester first before I go and explore.
Mm. At Leicester, two League Cups mm-hmm. and some magical times. Mm-hmm. The first League Cup final must go down as one of those. Well, in fact, I'm going to rewind a little bit in terms of gaining promotion. So, mm-hmm. you know, you were at Leicester, Championship side, and then suddenly promotion, Premier League.
Yeah.
That was your, I guess, your first real taste of footballing success on a big scale,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, definitely. Going to cup final, going to Wembley, which, well, it is a yeah. cup final. Going to Wembley, being there with all your fans, seeing a sea of blue when you're actually coming up Wembley Way and stuff like that. It's totally different now than what it was then. Obviously, the fans were all over the stadium outside and you see them, you're driving through them, you're trying to get through them.
Try not to run anywhere
yeah,
over.
Exactly. And then you're coming into the changing rooms, big, huge changing rooms, then going out into this big, grand stadium. And eventually winning that against Crystal Palace. I think it was Steve Claridge scoring the goal. And it's funny because I got fouled. The free kick went up. I think Steve Walsh headed it back and then he volleyed it. But I was fouled for the free kick. So I actually went off, didn't go off injured, but come off the pitch, come back on. And I didn't realise they'd made a substitute and put Zeljko Kalac in goal because he was like 6'9". Kevin Poole was probably at 6'1". And
you hadn't noticed the
honestly, I hadn't even noticed it. It wasn't until like a year or two later. And I was like, well, when did he come on the pitch?
Who's that?
Yeah. So, yeah, but that was great. A great day as well, you know, a great day out. And then obviously going up and generally, and it's still done now, whoever comes up is the favourite to go down. Mm. So we were favourite to go down and look, it is what it is. We had a really good bond. We had a really good group of players. The gaffer always made some good signings as well along the way that added to that environment. And to finish top half of the table and go to a cup final, well, win a cup final is good as well.
Yeah, win a cup final. So you get a trophy. Yeah, you get two trophies with Leicester. Mm-hmm. And then I suppose you're starting to think at 22 that this is perhaps the right time to move.
Yeah.
And it feels like Liverpool was such a good fit for you. But there was something that you underestimated to do with the move to the club. And tell us what that was.
Well, you know, it's a huge club and they'd been circling for a while and other clubs had been around. And it's funny because Gerard Houllier bought me and I played up front with Michael Owen for my England under 18. So he would have been 16 at the time. And he was the manager of the French under 18s then, had Henri, Anelka, Trezeguet, Galas, Silvestri. They had some Datus Mandabo, so yeah, it had all them players in it, and he became Liverpool manager, but always looked at when we played together for England under 18. So then he decided that he was gonna buy me. So went there, and obviously I'm a young lad. I've never moved out of Leicester. So gone there, and the size of the club is obviously huge, but you know about that. But then one of the things that struck me was, I got criticised for wearing a tracksuit in a press conference, but I didn't know. No one had told me, no one had wrote me that letter that needed to tell me, that note that says, make sure you wear a suit and tie. So I went there with a sponsored Puma, I think it was at the time, tracksuit and cap, and got criticised for it.
Yeah. Probably the only person who's ever been told off wearing a tracksuit in Liverpool. I mean, it's hardly an unusual thing, is it?
The Offside Rule exclusives.
You arrived at Liverpool earlier than you were meant mm-hmm. to be. Mm-hmm. So you kind of reveal this in your book, that there was kind of an agreement in place for quite a while before you actually went.
Yeah, I think it was the year before there was an agreement, or halfway through the year there was an agreement that I'd go at the end of the season.
Mm.
And then they kind of fast-forwarded that because they were chasing Champions League.
Champions League, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think
Leeds got it in the end.
And you were a record signing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that weight on your shoulders?
No.
Mm.
And I think it was good because I was young.
Mm.
I didn't overthink things.
Yeah.
And I think that's the great thing about having some young lads in your squad or in your team or something like that. They don't overthink things, they just do. All right, I know I play well, I know I can do this, all right, give me the ball, let me do this, and that's it.
Yeah.
They don't even overthink it. It's when you get a little bit older and you start thinking, oh, yeah, but if I pass that ball there and I give it away, oh, this is going to happen. And they start running that in their mind, where young lads, they don't. That doesn't actually go into their mind about giving the ball away. if they give the ball, all right, I'll get it back.
You can definitely aim that at the current England side, or you know how that Sancho, that innocence of youth.
Look at Jadon Sancho. Doesn't overthink things. He just knows what he's good at. Does it.
Yeah.
If he gives it away, gets it back and does it again.
Yeah,
you know,
true.
these players, you know, Raheem, even though we say he's still young, was he 25, 26?
Yeah, something like that, mid-20s.
He's been around for like 15 years already.
Yeah.
Feels like it.
That was the case as well with Michael Owen, it felt, at the time.
Yeah, but he came at 16.
Yeah, so 16-year-old, and you had this amazing relationship where you've got this understanding as a strike partnership, which we don't see many anymore. Mm-hmm. So much so that he, later on in your career, is sort of calling for you back with England as well, and he's a big part of the way that your career pans out later on in life. Mm-hmm. Was there a part of you that was seeing Michael Owen, who scored that goal that we all remember, that then got talked about, but he's doing that because of you as well, the way that you've set up goals and work together?
I think you need a collective team to do anything. He plays his role within that. He's the final part of the jigsaw within that, and we all play our role, and I was pretty happy to play my role within that system. It never really bothered me that anyone was getting more accolades, and as long as I can show that what I've done and my trophies and everything, I'm fine with that.
Well, you set up a lot of goals in your career.
Yeah, look, it was about what I was good at, and I knew I was good at that. I knew I could score goals. I could score a fair share of goals, and I did that, and I did the rest well as well. And this is why people, when it came to management, they looked upon me favourably than possibly others, that yes, they might score you one or two goals here, but what in the long run, what are they going to actually give
team
you?
Team player, yeah.
Yeah. So I understood that. I enjoyed that part of it. I enjoyed the rough and tumble of it. I enjoyed putting myself about for others. And this was me.
What was it like walking into that Liverpool side? So we've got, who have we got there? We've got Michael Owen, Robbie Fowler. Mm-hmm. We've got Steven Gerrard, Jamie Redknapp. Yeah. Carragher's there as
Carragher,
well.
Yeah. Carragher I knew from England. Me and Carragher, it's a funny story. Me and Carragher played together, England under 16s. I was on the bench, he was up front.
He was up front?
Yeah.
Hang on a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, this feels like a stupid question, but was he any good?
No, good. Very good player. Very, very good player. So, it was funny because when you fast forward and go to under 18s and I'm seeing him play at the back, I thought, what happened?
Yeah. What was the dynamic then like when you walked into Liverpool? Was there a job to do? Did you?
No, I was just another part of a jigsaw, because there was some top England internationals, top, you know, you got Stefan Hentcho, you got Sami Hyypiä, Titi Kamara, you got all these players who are in and around other national teams and doing well. So it was just about blending in with them. And it's funny because I went from Leicester, where you don't, in training it's fierce, but it's not overly, you know, you don't really tackle that hard and no sliding and all that. The only fierce day that we had was Friday, which is funny because it's a day before a game, but it was young v old. And it's for the yellow jersey. So whoever's the worst player, you get to vote for the worst player. And it's young, and you have to wear a jersey with all sorts of writing all over it.
I think I read about this. So this is at Leicester, isn't
it?
And this involves a really stinky yellow shirt.
Never gets washed.
It's just minging.
Yeah. And people add their names on it, and then you write stuff all over it. So you don't want to win that. So it's fierce. That's the only day that was really fierce. But every day was at Liverpool.
Every day was fierce.
Oh, when the first day I got there, Stefan Hentcho slide tucker straight through the back of me. I'm like,
hello there,
what
son?
Happened?
No time to breathe.
No tackling.
So England is concurrent with your Liverpool career as well. You've had many different England managers. So throughout the list, and in your book, you go through talking about Glenn Hoddle, Peter Taylor, Howard Wilkinson, Kevin Keegan, Sven, Steve McLaren, and then Fabio Capello as well. Mm-hmm. Of all of those, who brought out the best in you?
I liked Sven. He was very calm. I can deal with ranters and ravers, but I prefer the calmer ones.
Who was the ranter and raver at that bunch then?
We never really had any in England as such like that. Martin could go off.
Martin O'Neill, yeah.
Yeah, Martin could go off if you really push him. Fabio, just I think it's more Italian culture. You know, very passionate. But yeah, I preferred Sven. He was very calm. He would move. He would get like a little clipboard moving pieces around so you understood where what everything he that he wanted to do. Then you go over it in training, then he'd go back over it, and everything was, you know, precise. So I enjoyed that.
So in that evolution of you going through all those teams, I mean, the players that you'd been with, you know, you look at Paul Scholes, David Beckham, David Seaman, mm-hmm. Michael Owen, who we've mentioned already, and you're all quite young men when you're starting with England, and then you're settling down, getting girlfriends, wives, children along the way as you're plotting through, all the way through to Fabio Capello, when you're working with completely different players by the end. Mm-hmm. What did you make of all of that at the time, trying to have that personal life as well as, at that point, a lot of expectation on your shoulders from an England point of view? I mean, Beckham being the most famous example, I suppose, it was his relationship that would have been ongoing with Victoria at the time and all of that going on.
I didn't mind it, to be honest with you. It was part and parcel of life. So it was difficult in a sense that you're just not a normal person that can just go and do whatever he wants to do. And it's still now, you know, you'll be on the train or you'll be somewhere and someone will be taking a picture of you. Instead of coming and asking you to take a picture, they'll just be taking a picture of you. But you can ask, it's no problem.
Yeah. And you must have had to get used to that pointing to my camera phone.
Yeah. You get used to it, you know, from a very young age. And it's strange at first because especially someone keep looking at you.
Where do I know him from?
Yeah, like as a 17-year-old lad, 18-year-old lad. You know.
So Kate and I have known each other a long time, and mm-hmm. we've worked together at Sky, and then we've done this podcast together, and we sort of know each other's personal life stories. Is that something that you'd share? Because, you know, with the Heads Up campaign being quite prevalent at the moment, mm-hmm. I'm wondering that, you know, in the dressing room with all those big characters, whether you shared things with each other or whether you were all quite private and separate.
It depended on the group that you're with. So I put it in the book that when I was at Leicester, it was more family orientated. When I went to Liverpool, it felt like business. Mm. So you'd be at the club and everyone would be friend there. But once you leave, it's kind of see you later. But then you come back and then you're there together. Mm. And like I said, I said it again, I found that a little bit difficult at first because I'd gone from being with all the lads, we'd go to lunch together, and then you'd go and then you probably have a drink later together, and you go and have dinner together after the game and stuff like that. So it was all as a group. Mm. We're currently doing, was it the 20th year from the last time we won the League Cup? We're supposed to be getting together for that as well. So, you know, it's just little things that you organise together. But
so that Leicester life was really tight-knit. And
yeah, it was more of a family.
All quite involved in each other's lives. Yeah. And when you got to Liverpool, as you say, it was more business-like. Yeah. And you found it quite isolating, didn't you?
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough. I was only 22.
Yeah.
I'd moved out of my mum's house, but I'd moved around the corner, so it was kind of... It wasn't outside. It wasn't out of my mum's house, really. You know, it was around the corner.
The washing and the dinner.
Yeah, it's not right.
This is The Offside Rule from Muddy Knees Media.
I'm going to pick out a few things that you've gone on to mention in the book, because we know quite a lot about your career. I mean, there's lots that you cover in this. You know, when you signed for Villa, having played for Birmingham, brave man. last day relegation escape as well with Wigan is in there. Your move to Australia. Unfortunately, we haven't got forever to be able to chat. So I've just picked out a few points.
Yeah, go on.
The Michael Owen talking to Steve McLaren. You said you were really surprised when you got that phone call.
Yeah, I didn't expect the phone call. When you look at the actual squad, they had the squad. Mm. They had players. So to add another player, you're like, well, why would they do that? But it was funny because I got the phone call and I'd seen the number. I'm like, who is this? Answered it. And hi, Emil, it's Steve. All right, Steve. Steve McLaren. Thinking, do I hang up?
You just don't believe it.
No, because within football,
yeah,
these are pranks that happen all the time. The amount of times that we've had players, we're on the bus going to games, and there's an app that you can do where you text people. Back then, you would text people, and the app would be able to text a player like it's the manager texting them. I need to see you down at the front of the bus. So they walk down to the front of the bus to stand there, and the manager's there looking at him.
And had you fallen for this a few times?
I'd never. But I'd seen it a couple of times. Because by then I was a mid-senior player, so they wouldn't try that with me. But I did it a lot with the younger lads.
So when Steve's chatting to you, you're thinking, surely they're not trying this now.
Someone's having me on. But it happens all the time. So I carried on. I was like, okay, yeah, how are you doing, Steve? You okay? Yeah. Spoken to Michael, blah, blah. Would love to have you in the squad. And he goes, oh, great. Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah, I'm up for that. Yeah, cool. But it's not like I could have said, well, I'm not coming, am I?
But did you feel that he wanted you or that Michael wanted
you? More probably Michael.
So I mean, you're basically, this is on the back of kind of a small patch of wilderness in your England career. Mm-hmm. So you know, featured for England. Mm-hmm. How long had you gone without playing for them?
4 years.
4 years. Mm-hmm. So 4 year hiatus. Mm-hmm. And then Steve gets on the phone. And I don't want to take anything away from you here at all, but the way that you've just explained that, it's like Steve says, what can I do to make Michael happy? Michael wants a meal.
I don't know if it's to make Michael happy in a sense like that, but he probably looked at it and said, well, he could be, he's right. He's right. Let's get him in. Let's see. Because he got me in. It felt like he got me in, and then it was a trial again.
Wow.
And how old were you at this point?
What would I have been? 30?
Yeah. So, ridiculous.
Yeah, 30. Yeah, around that age. Yeah.
And you're a pretty chilled out guy.
Yeah. It didn't bother me.
Didn't it?
No.
Didn't it?
No. I just go out there and play.
Yeah.
By that time, I'd been out of it for 4 years. It's not like I don't know what international football is about. I'd played from the age of 16. So when I say 16, I mean...
in the unders.
Yes. Yeah. So I knew everything about it. You see other players that are coming in when they're 25, 26. It can be a little bit difficult. But when you've grown up within that, it's a little bit seamless when you can slot back in because you understand it a little bit more.
Rio Ferdinand was quite outspoken and mentioned the fact that this fierce club rivalry halted England's progress at that particular point when everyone was saying that they should have gone and won a tournament. Mm-hmm. And that the international stage suffered because of that. And in the book you say he was right when he said that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, look, it was there. But if we play together at Liverpool and then we come together for the national team and you've got Man United players there, we're going to sit here and they're going to sit there. We might cross over and shout something across over at each other, but generally we're going to sit together. And I saw it when I was at Liverpool. So I went from Leicester to Liverpool with the Liverpool lads when going national team. And then when I went back, I was a Wigan player. So no one else was in the squad with Wigan.
So you were the first, weren't you?
I was the first signed player, but Chris Kirkland was on loan.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, he was a Liverpool player.
So where on earth did you sit?
Well, with the rest.
Okay.
So you got your little groups and then the rest of them who make up the rest of the squad is there.
So do you think this is something that is never going to change? It's always going to be ingrained?
It'll be difficult to change because when you listen to the Scottish and the Irish, when they get together, it's all a party. So they're all together. They all go out eating together and they will organise all that. So it's kind of woven together, whereas we're just, unless you have placemats that's got Emil here, Rio there, this person there, that person there, we're all just going to sit together.
So hang on, this is a great point and actually gives you a bit of insight into why those teams with these superstar players in didn't click for that amount of time. Why couldn't players get over the rivalry and get on with playing for their country?
You look at what happened recently with Raheem Sterling and Joe Gomez, coming from a game, just played against each other, rivals, now coming together and trying to be teammates together. And it's ingrained. It's only just happened as well. So it's a difficult one to actually just separate yourself from them two teams and now being a teammate.
But surely that is the case for Germany, who at that period of when you were playing were having so much success. That would have been the same for their players. They'd have been playing
Spain.
For rivals.
Yeah. Look at Spain. Yeah. Spain have the biggest rivalry with the Barcelona and the Real Madrid. They're kicking each other on the pitch and they're doing all sorts of horrible. But then they come together and they go and win the... But I haven't not got the answers, but yeah.
Maybe it is placemats.
It could be.
I think
and then you
I
force,
think you're definitely onto something here.
You're forced to speak to the person on your left for 5 minutes and then the person on your right for five.
Football's version of speed dating, perhaps. Make everyone talk to each other. How would you sum up your England career?
Good. I went to 2 World Cups and 2 Euros. I should have gone to 3 Euros, but I never went to 06. No, World Cup, sorry. I never went to 06. And
is that one of your biggest regrets?
What do you mean?
Well...
No, I went to 2, so I'm happy.
Yeah.
The 08... We never qualified. I got injured, and then we never qualified, did we? So
no,
that was a tough one.
When you were playing as well, it wasn't as much as what we're seeing nowadays. the fact that players were encouraged to open up about certain issues. And now it feels like there is sort of a political aspect now that goes with being a professional footballer, if you want it.
Yeah.
You know, you've seen it in the women's game with Megan Rapinoe. You've seen it with Raheem Sterling, who's written brilliant articles. I think Andros Townsend recently did something about gambling for the Players' Tribune. Had you got your time again, would you have done more to do with the racism that you'd experienced?
If football was open to that, football wasn't open to that. Then you've got to remember, regardless of what we could actually talk about, whether we were in private, we could have a good discussion. You weren't allowed to say certain things when you go into the public, and again, there was this notion that footballers are stupid. That was something that people had to keep portraying, that no, we shouldn't get involved in that because that's not your remit. Well, I've got a view on that. I've got a view on this, and that, why can't I? No, this is what you need to do. You just run around for 90 minutes and kick a ball. That's all they wanted us to be and to look like. So we just stuck by that, and if we ever came out of that remit, we were kind of pushed back in.
Who of the current crop of players who have spoken out, whether it is about racism, whether it's about mental health, who do you admire? Who do you think's done
Raheem,
a good job?
Raheem was the first, and I admire him because it's not easy being the first, because that's the one's going to get a lot of slapping and kicking. The first guy always gets the most slaps and kicks, and then the ones after take less and less and less. But he did it in a very, very smart way, where he's making people look back at themselves. Rather than just having a pointing a finger, it made people look back at themselves and say, "Oh, okay, I understand now."
Okay. And it was ingrained, yes, really, yeah. in attitudes.
And it's always been there. You know, there's so many stories we can talk about, but the thing is, no use us going back and saying, "No, yeah, but that happened to us, and we did this."
How many racist incidents a year do you think were thrown at you?
A year.
How often would you experience it?
Well, the national team, you got it mainly when you went abroad.
And there are incidents like, you know, yeah, Slovakia, yeah, Croatia. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's not improved that much, has it,
in certain sectors?
No. So.
In our game, I never really got much.
Domestically,
I never really got much. But that doesn't mean it's not there, because I could walk down the road and get... I could walk down the road and get more than I did playing a football
match. Playing on the pitch.
And... I'm from Leicester, so I recently had some forum, a BAME forum or something that I went down, and a lot of them are family friends that I grew up with, next door to and everything, so it was interesting to see them and their point of view for it. So when I played Sunday League football, I never played Sunday League football in my area. For some reason, I went to a small village outside, just on the outskirts of Leicester. It was because someone else's dad wanted me to play for them, and they would pick me up and take me there. And I was at the time, I was the only black player playing. So I never got racism. But then hearing their point of view from racism, because there's 10, 12, 14 black kids, it's totally different to mine. And I'm like listening to theirs, and I'm thinking, well, why didn't I get that? Because I was the only one. I was actually the only one there. And then hearing theirs and people coming on the pitch trying to trip them up and people swearing, calling them all sorts of horrible names. Wow. And this is kids.
You've got seven children now.
Yeah, yeah.
And any going into football?
Yeah, yeah. The two youngest boys play. They're doing well, enjoying it. So I just leave them.
They're with Manchester City still?
Yeah. They're enjoying it. I actually didn't want them to play, but their mum took them, so I just leave them.
Can't have your genes, can you?
No, they're doing well.
As a Liverpool fan myself, I'm going to have to talk about the treble.
Full declaration.
Yes.
Yeah. Because that must be one of those periods of time where stuff just went right.
Yeah.
And right.
Everything.
And right.
Yeah. And the amount of games that you played, and it just kept on going right.
Yeah.
You know, you go to cup final. And I think by the end of that season was just a phenomenal season.
So
you know,
2000, 2001.
Yes. Start the season off. And we're doing well. We're playing some really good football. Houllier was fantastic, by the way.
And you're fairly new into the side. You've only been there since March, right?
Yes. I started playing, and then obviously me and Michael had a great combination, great relationship. And again, we had a lot of England players, so I kind of knew them as well. and then to go to win the League Cup, well, obviously first FA Cup, and then the UEFA Cup. The UEFA Cup, I tell people, I actually don't remember the UEFA Cup.
Really?
We played 60...
Well, you played Roma, Olympiacos, Porto, yeah. Barcelona.
No, in total that season, we played 62, between 62 and 65 games.
A lot.
I played 58 games. I don't remember the last.
And this season, Liverpool could play, if they get to every final, 65 games yeah. is the treble on.
There you go. Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, yeah. when you're looking at the way they play as well, they're so confident. And I didn't expect them to play the way they did when they actually beat Leicester. Coming back from Qatar and jet lag and then the flights and all that, the travelling alone takes a lot out of you.
Mm.
But to come back and play the way they did...
Yeah, I know.
Jeez.
That was a marker, wasn't it? And,
yeah.
and obviously, you know, going back to your own career, 2000-2001, you're the first English side post-Heysel to win that UEFA Cup.
Mm-hmm.
So you were making history... playing Barcelona, and you had a shirt from Patrick Kluivert.
Yes. Yeah.
So you can remember that.
Yeah, yeah, I remember that. And I got Rivaldo's as well.
Wow.
And I have none of them either. My dad took them both.
What did he do with them? Frame them?
Yeah, he's got them.
Yeah.
He's got them.
And your trophies, what happened to those?
My dad's took some of them. Some of them got stolen, and I've got one or two of them, I think.
Are you sentimental?
No.
No. So for you, it's all about what's up in your head.
I would love to have them at the end of the day.
Yeah, of course.
But if I lose them, it doesn't bother me.
I love the way that you spoke about Steven Gerrard in the book, because you said that he up close is one of the best players you've ever played with.
Yeah, yeah.
There were also points in your book where you spoke about Tony Cotti, and we're talking a huge period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Any others that really shone?
Gary Mack was great. Gary Mack came to Liverpool at the same time as me. Gary Mack was 36 when he came to Liverpool.
When he went to Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. 36 and it made a difference. He was at the front of all the running at 36. I felt ashamed. I was 22. and he became a father figure on the pitch, and that leading figure on the pitch for us that we needed. Because I was 22, Michael would have been 20, so Stevie would have been 19.
Yeah,
we had,
and you needed that presence.
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, I can so strongly remember that time, and I can remember how he would, you know, in kind of sad moments, sort of almost hold you close.
Yep.
Yeah.
So we needed that senior figure. Yes, we had the energy. Yes, we had the skill and the strength, but you need that know-how.
And that was so perceptive of Julio, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He was.
He knew you needed it.
Yeah, he was brilliant.
Yeah.
He was brilliant like that.
You finished your career at Bolton, so you went off, you did Wigan, Villa, you went to play in the A-League over in Australia for Newcastle Jets, you wanted to get back to play for an English club, you went to Bolton, short-term contract there, and in the book you say, my heart keeps bringing me back to football.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a really lovely thing to say.
The thing is, that's all I've known.
Yeah.
From the age of 9, yes, I do say that my first love was athletics, but I played football from the age of 9. Especially at Leicester, until 38. So it's all I've known. And I would love to stay in it, hence why I'm doing a course right now.
Tell us about that then. So what
you UEFA course. It's a Masters for International Players. They've decided that they were, I think it was about 3 years ago. And it's funny because they offered me it 3 years ago and I turned it down.
Why?
I wasn't ready mentally to get into a classroom.
Yeah,
It's the classroom
yeah,
thing.
Yeah,
like
that was it.
16, the last time you were.
Yeah, that was
one.
It. That was it. And three or four years have gone by, but two different classrooms have gone. Jason Roberts did the first one, and Cillian Petrov did the second one.
Yeah,
and I've spoke to them about it, and they said, "No, you've got to do it. You've got to do it. This is what it's all about. We'll help you get through it." Blah blah blah. I'm like, okay. Breathe.
Well, you're in good company.
Yeah,
two,
there's any
Elo
could do it. Any Elo could do it. So
now she's just gone to Aston Villa.
Yeah. There's so many who've done it. Bruno Giroud did it, who I played with at Liverpool. He's the manager of Paris Saint-Germain Women's.
So where are you going to go with this then?
Are we seeing a director of football of the future?
We hope so.
Wow, that's really nice.
We hope so.
Yeah.
We hope so. It's, you know, if it's only thing that you know But you've got to aim high. I aimed high when I was playing football, so why not when I take this next bit?
Yeah, because you sort of quashed the kind of coaching rumours about whether you do coaching. You've got a real football brain.
Yeah, right? And I think everyone see, like, even when I finish playing, oh, go and get your badges. Why? What if you're not even asking me if I want to do it? Why can't I be higher up? So I love football. My kids are playing it. I hope they do very well. I still want to give back into football. So why not?
Seems like a lovely place for us to stop. I'm wondering if I had any burning questions I haven't got to ask. There is one.
Go on.
It's to do with Wembley. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued that you felt that the players like being closer to the fans, that 2001 period mm-hmm. where you went round the country. Mm-hmm. I wondered if going forward that might be something that England could benefit from.
I think they're looking into that. I know that they're looking into that for certain games that allowing the fans going on the road. Obviously, certain games you need to be in Wembley, 90,000. There's other games especially for the likes of Newcastle. I'm up in the northwest, so coming down here is 2.5 hours to get down here, then go to the game, and then 2.5 back up. It's not easy at times, so having it in different places would be great for them fans. But obviously, there's select games that you have to have in London. You have to have at Wembley.
Mm-hmm. We know your life has been football, and In the book, you reveal that Tony Cotty said to you, mm-hmm. you've got to have something away from football. Yeah. What is your thing away from football?
I didn't have one.
Do you have one yet?
No, this course.
That's a football course.
Yeah, I know. Football away from football.
To be continued. Netflix.
Yeah, exactly. But the thing is, as a young lad, you don't want to hear that from a senior pro. And it's not till you are older you think...
Was he right?
Yeah. Because I even tell people now, if you're playing football and you can't get your mind off football, it can eat your way at you, especially if you're not going through a great period at that time. It can eat your way at you. If you've got some other things to do, or you've got another hobby or whatever it is, and you can take your mind away from it, at least you can give yourself a little bit of a relief. And you see these players have mental health problems where they can't get themselves out.
Escape. Yeah.
And it's a bubble that is... And I was lucky enough to get out of that bubble when I went to Australia.
That's a long time to have been in that bubble, though.
Yeah.
And you're still sane.
Yeah.
Just about.
No, yeah.
You are very, very relaxed. you are a very relaxed person.
Yeah, yeah.
And the privilege of social media nowadays, I think one of the solutions to this is dogs. Because a lot of players have dogs now. You look at Alexis Sanchez's feed, and there's loads of different Arsenal players actually have dogs. Mark Noble, mm-hmm. he used to bring his dog to training at West Ham. Maybe those sorts of interests.
So, like taking them for a walk or something.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Rather than golf dogs, maybe. Yeah. Yeah, because you can get injured doing other things, but if you're just walking a dog.
Unless the dog runs into you.
The Great Dane of Beethoven. Thank you so much. We wish you all the best.
Thank you
for joining us. No problem. We wish you all the best with the book as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Offside Rule exclusive. To hear more just like this one, you can go to available episodes where you can hear from the likes of former England strikers Jermaine Defoe, Kelly Smith and others. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Offside Rule Pod, and you can also subscribe so you can be the first to hear our new episodes.
The Offside Rule is a Muddy Knees Media production. For sales and advertising, email sales@muddyneesmedia.com.
Muddy Knees Media.